This event is presented by the Council on Foreign Relations.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Council on Foreign Relations Local Journalist Conference Call Series. I'm Irina Faskanis, Vice President for the National Program and Outreach here at CFR. As you may know, CFR is an independent and nonpartisan organization and think tank focusing on U.S. foreign policy. This call is part of CFR's Local Journalist Initiative, created to help you connect the local issues you cover in your communities to global dynamics. Our programming puts you in touch with CFR resources and expertise on international issues and provides a forum for sharing best practices. We know that as journalists, you have an important responsibility to keep the public informed about COVID-19 and its implications, both in the short term and the long term. And we thank you for taking the time from your deadlines, reporting deadlines, to be with us. I want to remind everybody that the call is on the record. The audio and transcript will be posted on our website after the fact at cfr.org/localjournalist. We shared full bios for our speaker, Dr. Vin Gupta, and our host, Carla Ann Robbins, prior to the call. So I'll just highlight a few things from their bios. Dr. Vin Gupta is an affiliate assistant professor of health metric sciences at the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation at the University of Washington. His research interests include pulmonary and critical care medicine. Dr. Gupta holds an active commission as major in the United States Air Force Reserve Medical Corps, and he recently served as the primary public health consultant on pandemic emergency financing for the World Bank. He is also an NBC News and MSNBC medical contributor and is a term member of the Council on Foreign Relations. Carla Ann Robbins is an adjunct senior fellow at CFR. She's faculty director of the Master of International Affairs program and clinical professor of national security studies at Baruch College's Marx School of Public and International Affairs. Previously, she was deputy editorial page editor at the New York Times and chief diplomatic correspondent at the Wall Street Journal. So welcome to you both, Vin and Carla. Thank you very much for being with us. And I'm going to turn it over to Carla to have a conversation with Dr. Gupta, and then we'll open up to you for questions. So, Carla, over to you.
Great. Irina, thank you so much, and I want to thank all the reporters who are on the line today, and thank you all for doing the work that you're doing under incredibly challenging circumstances. In fact, I can't even imagine how you're doing what you're doing. It seems like a very different world from even a few years ago when I was doing this. So, as Irina said, conversation on the record, Dr. Gupta and I are going to chat for about 15 minutes or so, and then we're going to turn it over to you all for your questions. So the federal coronavirus social distancing rules expire today, and the president said on Wednesday that it's now going to be up to the governors to decide what rules to follow. We're seeing a wide variety of responses around the country. In fact, there's a really good interactive map at the New York Times today. And you see states, it ranges everything from Georgia, where the gyms and bowling alleys and the famous tattoo parlors, as well as theaters and stores and restaurants with limited service are reopening. Texas retail stores, restaurants, movie theaters, and malls will be reopening with limited numbers. Tennessee, people are eating in restaurants again. Retail stores and gyms are about to reopen. Florida will be allowing restaurants and stores to operate at 25% capacity on the 4th. Oklahoma, people and pets can get their haircuts. Damn, I'd love to get a haircut. Restaurant dining, movie theaters, gyms, houses of worship, and sports stadiums are opening tomorrow with some restrictions. Colorado, people can get haircuts. I won't even say it again. So here's my first question for you, Dr. Gupta. How do we know if a state or city is ready to reopen?
Thanks, Carla, and thanks, Irina, for having me back and for everybody on joining this call. Second, everything Carla said in terms of all the great work that all of you are doing, and please keep that up. We really need truth and honesty as much as we can, facts to help inform health policy. So thank you. Carla, it's an important question and something that I know myself as an epidemiologist and as a clinician, my colleagues at the Institute for Health Metrics have been wrestling with, because there is a concern that how can you possibly know what's happening when it comes to case detection rates if we're only testing about 1% of the population currently? And if the goal here, as the president laid out just a few days ago, is, well, the aspiration is 2% of the state's population, again, the same problem arises. How do we actually know what's truly happening with infection rates in a given locale? We don't. There's a lot of blind spots here. And so either we say to ourselves, we're never going to know the answer because, practically speaking, we're never going to get to mass testing, as Dr. Birx said on Meet the Press on Sunday, Or we say, how do we navigate the unknown as safely as possible and move from an essential, non-essential paradigm of opening up? So let's go away from what we think is essential workers and non-essential workers to what's safe and unsafe, and how do we engage with each other again in public in a way that's safe and science-based. I think we're headed towards the latter, and the reason why is there's a lot of skepticism on models like the one that IHME has produced. There's a lot of haggling between academics about what's the right model. And I think the appetite, as you're seeing from the president, his administration, and large segments of the American public is we've had it with these models. We've had it with public health individuals like myself prescribing doomsday scenarios. People want to try it out. They want to see. I was just on an ICU shift last night. I was working with nurses caring for COVID critically ill patients, and even they were saying, we just need to see what happens and be smart about it. So I think the focus of this conversation is going to be less about let's get mass testing, contact tracing in practice, even though that's what everybody's preaching. In practice, it's going to be how do we open up safely?
And so you're making a really interesting distinction, essential versus non-essential, and as well as safe versus not safe. If we're going to go back there, what can we open up safely, knowing that, you know, if the numbers spike, we're going to have to potentially shut down again? So are there certain businesses that can be reopened more safely than others?
I think this is something that you and I and everyone on the call could probably iterate on. What do we think safe? I think, for example, we would never think of a car wash service as essential, but is it safe? And do people's livelihoods matter on car washes being open? Yeah, I think it's safe. I actually think it's okay that we're having people drive through a car wash, for example. And that's been kind of a cited example of an industry that we could open up. It's small, of course, but that's the example. How do we can businesses that by definition have some degree of distance between the customer and the company or the person selling the product, can we open those businesses up and have a little bit more flexibility? And I'm sure you and I and others can come up with a list of what that could look like. Do I think tattoo parlors in Georgia constitutes an essential need? No. Is it safe? No, it's not, even if we try our best to adopt evidence-based public health practices. So this is where common sense is going to help guide some of these greater discussions that our governors across the country, our mayors across the country are having. But it's not difficult to understand, in a broad sense, okay, if proximity is not an issue, then maybe we can consider opening up national parks where, Gavin Newsom, for example, just closed down beaches because people were given a leash to say, okay, let's see how this goes. And or there wasn't any strict moratorium against you can't walk in a beach, for example, or at least on the outside of a beach. And then people didn't follow the rules. And so now he just issued a moratorium against congregation at beaches or at state parks. Could that be relaxed as, if we're seeing that because of local or state reporting, people are adopting rules like wearing masks? They're willing to download apps from big tech companies that allow for contact tracing. They're abiding by social distancing rules at the ice cream shop. If we're seeing some degree of cooperation with ostensibly voluntary asks, then I think that changes the nature of the discussion too. It's going to be incremental, but it's going to require a lot of cooperation on the part of Americans to rules and regulations that some will interpret as voluntary, but that are absolutely essential to abide by to keep us safe. And I think if people are willing to abide by these things, masks, social distancing, even when things normalize, contact tracing as informed by tech companies and as facilitated by tech companies, then I think we can have a different conversation.
So if you're saying that we don't have anywhere near enough testing to really know, are you saying that the decisions on reopening is not going to really be metric-based? It's going to be solely politically based?
Practically, yes. The academic in me would say, of course it needs to be testing-based. Of course that's what everybody on the public health side is testing, contact tracing. You can't meet, you probably haven't had an hour go by after watching the news where that those phrases have not been uttered repeatedly. But specificity here is important. And right now, and this is Dr. Brooks saying this, not me, I'm paraphrasing her, as currently constructed, our testing infrastructure is not going to get us to mass testing, however you want to define that. To 500,000 tests a day, as identified by my colleagues at the Chan School up at Harvard, is it 30 million every week, as identified by Rockefeller? What is it? So that's a moving target. Everybody has a different definition. But we're just having the wrong conversation when it comes to testing. We're diagnosing that this is a need. But what's the solution? This is where the mixed messaging, the unfortunate messaging coming from the very top at the White House has caused us to not have the right conversations at these White House press briefings. So instead of talking about disinfectants or why isn't Vice President Pence wearing a mask, we should be talking about saliva testing at home, because saliva testing is outperforming nasopharyngeal testing, that swab into your nose, by a large margin, as identified by Yale scientists and as first discovered by Rutgers scientists, who actually had the first commercially available saliva-based test in the United States that was approved by the FDA in the middle of April. We don't have – correct me if I'm wrong. Have you heard Dr. Brooks or Dr. Fauci even have the opportunity to talk about that specific test? I haven't, because they've been defending the indefensible. And so that's a problem. And so we need to be talking about – if we're really talking about mass testing as informing a return to work, return to normalcy strategy, we need to be having the right conversation. We need our public health leaders to talk about how do we get to scaled mass testing using saliva maybe at home and mailing it back. All the ingredients are there. I won't rabbit hole. I can if there's interest. But we can get this done quickly. We're just not having the right conversation. So, yes, as a result, I think it's going to be political. You're already seeing states open up in the absence of data. So it's already political.
So just two other questions I want to turn it over. One is, are there lessons to be learned from how South Korea or China or Germany or other countries are reopening, both positive lessons and cautionary lessons as we go about doing this?
I don't think we're going to want to hear it. Certainly our current administration is not going to want to hear it. But, yeah, there are many positive lessons. So South Korea, basically we got the same intel from the WHO that South Korea did in the middle of January. They gave technical guidance on what testing should be done, how to do it. And one country adopted it, South Korea did, and one country didn't, we did not. And their per capita testing rates went through the roof. Ours, as you know, are lagging in the bottom 20 of the most developed economies in the world. And so part of this is we should be humble. We should be willing to listen to experts, even if they're the much maligned WHO. It turns out there were elements of what they did that were right, obviously elements of what they did that were wrong. So that's one. From China, again, this is going to be a hard lesson for us, but – every model, one of the big criticisms of the IHME model is that its premise, all its forecasts on what happens if social distancing gets relaxed on May 7th in Georgia versus May 14th is premised on social distancing looking like what it looked like in Wuhan. And I think we can all agree we do not have a homogenous approach to social distancing, certainly not across the country, but even within the state, even within certain parts of the county. I'm in Seattle, the first epicenter. I see different things just on a 10-mile drive to and from the hospital. And so we need to be real, and I think we need to be honest about our shortcomings as a country when it comes to adopting these really difficult policies. And so, I think there are very important lessons about how to do effective containment of an outbreak that are just hard for a large country like the United States to adopt, because it requires a lot in the way of personal sacrifice and strong leadership and strong messaging.
So in states that are reopening, what do we as reporters need to be writing about?
think the most important thing is, are people cooperating? Are you noticing in your communities that these linchpins of a successful return to work strategy that are not testing based, they're wearing masks, they're people cooperating with social distancing norms, even as we normalize. There may be public perception of contact tracing and how it's going and whether people are willing to adopt app-based technologies that may infringe on their perception of personal privacy. Those are critical linchpins of if the answer to that is everybody's willing and to sacrifice and do what's prescribed, then we return back to normal more quickly. And it's not based on testing. It's just based on us all doing the same thing for the greater good. But understanding what's happening and variabilities across communities with respect to those three big buckets would be extremely helpful, because then we know how effective policies are. There's some measure of accountability to local and state government about what is and is not effective, and does there need to be greater regulation, what have you. So I think that qualitative sense of what's actually happening when it comes to adoption of these guidelines, in some cases there's just guidelines and suggestions depending on the state, would be critically helpful.
And what's the time frame, I mean, between reopening and knowing whether or not it's working, you know, that they're taking enough steps, or that we're going to spiral back into a profound problem? Is this 2 weeks, 3 weeks? I mean, how do we denominate the time frames here?
Yes, Carla, it's a tough question, but it's an important question. I guess this comes down to what's practical. Inslee, for example, Governor Inslee laid down a pretty strict order in terms of a lockdown on March 23rd, and we noticed an immediate change. My wife and I both petitioned on the next day, on March 24th, driving into work, and so. I think this is going to be ultimately in the eye of the beholder, in the eye of the journalist in your communities. But what's the immediate impact? And then what's the immediate week? What's the change a week out? And are you noticing the line is not holding a month out? So I think some time series component to this is what happened the day after X social distancing was liberalized, and a week out and a month out helps give a good frame for all of us on the public health side to see what's working, what's not, are people cooperating, are they not.
And just the lag on infection rates, and when we talk about a potential spike or, you know, the W image or whatever on infection rates and death rates, I mean, is it 2 weeks, 3 weeks? I mean, if we know it's failing or we know it's working, should we be looking 2 weeks out, 3 weeks out, 4 weeks out? What's the time frame on that?
Where I think there's no distance between those in public health on the academic side and on the government side or on the task force is 2 weeks is a great metric, because we know that if you're going to develop symptoms from COVID-19 after an exposure, it usually happens within 2 weeks. If you're going to develop evidence of virus in your body, it usually, if it hasn't occurred within 2 days, frankly, it's unusual. But by 2 weeks, if you've been exposed and you haven't been infected, then you're likely not going to ever be infected. So 2 weeks is a good number, because it allows us to see amongst those that have a likely exposure who's truly infected, and you're not likely to miss anything if you extend out to 2 weeks. So every 2 weeks, getting a reassessment of infection rates, looking at what's happening with testing so we can have some quantitative assessment of what's actually happening is going to be helpful. But every 2 weeks, what's the infection rate? How have things changed on that time frame makes clinical sense, just given how COVID-19 behaves in the body.
Great, thank you. So, Operator Brandon, can we throw it open to all of our colleagues on the phone?
Yes, ma'am. At this time, we will open the floor for questions. If you would like to ask a question, please dial the star key followed by the one key on your touch-tone phone now. Questions will be taken in the order in which they are received. If at any time you would like to remove yourself from the questioning queue, simply dial star 2. Again, to ask a question at this point, please dial star 1. Caller, your information was not captured. If you would please identify yourself before asking your question. Your line is live.
Yeah, this is John Hancock. I'm the editor of Data and Interactives at the Dallas Morning News. And have kind of two questions, really. One, here in Dallas County, we're seeing the county officials really moderating hospital stays and critical cases. Is this a good data point, given that the lockdowns are really trying to avoid asymptomatic spread? And the second question I would have is, when we're trying to moderate or trying to look at infection rates, one of the problems we have with Texas is that on a county level, about 25% on a daily basis when they release the county level testing, the county is unknown. So it's really hard for us to kind of get a good gauge of what a county's infection rate is. Is there a way around that, or are we just kind of waiting on the state to catch up?
Thanks for the question. So I'm going to tackle question two first and then ask just a clarification on your first question. So we are, IHME is at the University of Washington is working towards county level estimates. And so we should hopefully be able to get some visibility on what's happening at that level, soon enough, just because we're beholden to the data that gets sent to us. And right now it's aggregated at the state level. But we're expecting it to be reported at the county level in the next 2 weeks. So hopefully we should be able to address that problem for you pretty quickly, and I can make sure that that's a point of follow-up. In the interim, Al, this is a question back for you. Is your county Department of Health able to directly report figures, or are they funneling that up to the State Department of Health and not directly to media outlets? Because here in Seattle, we're able to get King County figures specifically just for King County.
Yeah, on a testing level, they're funneling it up to the state. We get like daily case and death numbers from the county, but the county just a couple days ago started releasing county testing figures on a daily basis. Before, they were doing it every week or so. But even as of yesterday, with 300,000 tests having results in Texas, and results of tests in Texas, 76,000 of those have yet to have a county assigned to where that test came from. So, you know, one of the things we're trying to look at is the infection rates of counties, especially given that some are rural but have industries that are ripe for infections like meatpacking industries or something like that. But
right.
But there being such a large number of those tests that are unassigned to a county, I personally don't feel safe saying, you know, positives divided by tests gives us an infection rate when there's so many tests that have yet to get assigned.
Yeah, no, and that's good of you not to call that out and to be mindful. You are, as you've already figured out, you're captive to how the data is being reported, and the denominator here is key. So the data that we would be providing you directly is only as good as the data that we receive in. So it sounds like it's an issue with data categorization and kind of identifying these uncategorized tests, which no one's going to be able to do outside of Texas. So I hope that's going to be circumnavigated. But the last thing you want to do is, you know, to me, we model a lot, but I think this is not something you would want to model and build an uncertainty around an estimate for how many tests are happening. So I'm happy to kind of help offline if you'd like kick tires about how we can. We have multiple contacts, and as I'm sure you do, and local and state departments of health, if there's a way for us to help standardize data definitions and make sure things are cleaned up, because it only helps us to provide a more aggregated picture of what's happening at the national level.
Thank you.
I know you had a first question, too, and I just wanted to make sure I answered that. Would you mind just paraphrasing? Because I just want to make sure I was answering the right question.
Yeah, so Dallas County is putting a lot of emphasis on, I guess, how well they're doing by moderating length of hospital stays and critical cases in the hospital. How strong of a data point is this if the whole purpose of the lockdown was largely to prevent asymptomatic spread?
Yeah, no, I'm with you. I'm surprised to hear that. I mean, I think it's important to understand what's happening on the inpatient side, but we know in some cases, 9 of every 10 patients, people that are transmitting COVID-19 are asymptomatic, never touch a hospital setting or interact with a provider. So I think that's a metric to be monitored, length of stay inpatient for. So that's important to understand what's your capacity in Dallas. So if, as you open things up, and I know Dallas is opening things up, if you got it wrong, or if your governor got it wrong, state leaders got it wrong, and you open up too quickly, what's the surge capacity look like? And so having some sense of what's open, how many open beds you have, and modeling that out is going to be critical. But it's not. It's super effective to understand the effectiveness of social distancing, which is what I think you're getting at. What's better for that, and let's see if I can – I'll send this to Arena. We had talked about this on the first call, which was the best way to determine the impact of social distancing is to look at fever density. And is fever across the Dallas zip code – what are you seeing? And there's actually connected devices, connected thermometers that people use across the country that provide this data. And the CDC is co-opting this data to basically demonstrate that fever activity across all zip codes in the United States is dramatically less than it's been, than it usually is this time of year in a typical flu season. And you can look down at the Dallas County level or more, you know, at the national level. But that's the metric you actually want to look at is and it doesn't get to your question of symptomatic versus asymptomatic, because who really knows what's going on with asymptomatic transmitters? But a good surrogate of that question, a metric to see what the effectiveness of social distancing is, to see its impact on fever density, because it's virtually impossible to look at see what's happening with asymptomatic transmission in this type of environment, other than to do mass testing and to see what's really happening with new cases, which, as you know, is an aspiration at this point.
Thank you.
Thank you for the question.
Brandon, we have another question.
I was just going to give a quick reminder. If you have a question at this time, please dial *1 to enter the queue. We are currently holding for questions. Oh, we have a question from Allison Schaefer's with Honolulu Star Advertiser. Please go ahead.
Aloha. Because of its isolation, Hawaii had a unique opportunity to control its borders and collapse tourism. The state is still talking about continued quarantines for out-of-state passengers and implementing tracking devices like ankle bracelets, GPS tracking, Facebook recognition, and more. What's your sense of what other states are doing about travel as the country reopens, and what discussions do you think should be taking place about how travel is handled as it played an early role in the pandemic spread, and not all destinations are equal in their public health recovery or policies?
It's such a good question. Thank you for that question. So this is complicated, and I'll just spend a minute talking about the debate on travel bans. And so travel restrictions has its antecedents in a post-SARS world, where the WHO came out with something called the International Health Regulations. And one of the tenets of that, which every country, including us, signed on to, was we don't put border restrictions. Border restrictions, travel bans just don't work. And the data right now bears itself out. I'm going to go global and then come local. Globally, the countries that implemented travel bans against China, right as things got out of control in Wuhan, actually have more per capita cases than the countries that kept flights going in and out of Wuhan, or allow basically the countries that didn't preemptively stop flights coming in from China have less per capita rates of infection from COVID than the countries like us that at some point decided we're not accepting any more flights. So that's one piece. Bans just don't work. Pandemics, diseases of pandemic potential find a way, especially respiratory diseases. They just find a way. That's one. Number two, practically bans don't work because 40,000 Chinese Americans and Chinese citizens have traversed the Pacific Ocean between China and the United States since our administration put the ban in place back in February. I don't remember the exact date. So there's leakage. It's also to say that I don't like bans because they promote lack of collaboration, especially across countries, but even within states. And what you really want is data transparency in this data void that we currently live in. And if we start implementing bans from New York, or initially there was thoughts to quarantine all of Seattle, there's the fear, will Seattle and our leaders here in Seattle feel comfortable sharing data more broadly? Or are they going to be worried about the economic consequences of being perceived as a hot zone and being further curtailed and quarantined off for who knows how long? This is the calculation that many countries have determined is the right calculation, i.e. bans will lead to data transparency will lead to bans. Therefore, let's not be transparent. Let's minimize collaboration. So it gets to your question, which is I can understand why people think Hawaii can ban its way out of new cases. I'm a skeptic. Many people may disagree with me. I think COVID has obviously found a way to everywhere, every pocket of the world, and it's better to index on collaboration and a joint effort and full transparency than it is to do otherwise. I don't think we're ever going to get to the point where we're going to have sort of central areas of quarantine like they did in China. It just we can't even adhere to a homogenous approach to social distancing, which is, you know, Wuhan lockdown light. So we're never going to get to the point, I think, politically where we're going to do central areas of quarantine. Do I think we're going to get to a point where we'll do some degree of containment and quarantine individual cases, or maybe quarantine individual houses or nursing homes? That, yes, but I don't think entire cities. I don't know if that answers your specific question, but I'm happy to clarify.
I'm just wondering, too, as we get back to traveling as a public, what different recommendations would you have for the travel industry to accommodate public safety concerns as well as just to try to prevent any spread, additional spread, as we were covering?
So I'll say this as a pulmonologist, that the messaging on masks has been been atrocious from the highest levels. There's been mixed messaging, when the data is clear, and the data is clear that even if I was having this conversation with you in person and I was infected but asymptomatic with COVID-19, and you didn't have a mask on you, or if I didn't have a mask on me, I would be spraying you with droplets if we're within 3 feet of each other filled with COVID-19. Normal speech, we know now, has the capability of emitting droplets that carry millions of COVID-19 virus particles. So I was a skeptic about masks initially as well, but now there's great data published in the New England Journal of Medicine that says that's key. So any air travel, and frankly, any type of public engagement, going to a restaurant, what have you, until we feel confident that coronavirus is no longer disseminating at high rates. Again, we don't know what's truly happening right now because we don't have enough testing. Until we feel confident, we all need to be wearing masks. And so JetBlue, for example, has required that every passenger needs to have a fabric mask or something, at minimum a fabric mask. And the last thing we want to do is encourage uptake of medical PPE. So some type of face covering is going to be absolutely mandatory whenever out in public where there's a chance to be socially intimate with other people. And I think, you know, this is going to seem pretty obvious, but it can't be said enough times. Infection control more broadly has to be top of mind. So whereas Carla mentioned she really wanted to get a haircut, I really want to get a haircut. I probably wouldn't have washed my hands before and after a haircut in a pre-COVID world. Now I'm going to. And now we should all be doing that. And so we're going to have a different ethos when it comes to public health, how we consume healthcare too. I think it's going to be more through connected devices and through telemedicine. I think people are going to self-regulate their willingness to engage with others anyway. So we're going to live in a different world. But practically speaking, getting on a flight to go on a vacation is going to require masks. It's going to require infection control, common sense things being top of mind. And then I think when it comes to restaurants and other public establishments, there's going to have to be every restaurant, every store is going to have to implement some type of social distancing measure. And whether it's a Costco or a Home Depot, where I'm sure all of you, or a grocery store where maybe many of you have seen, only a certain amount of people can go into a store before you have to have certain egress and before entry of just individuals to control density. I think that's going to be a more common theme as restaurants start opening up, just so we can all be safe.
Thank you. Brandon?
Thank you for the question. Again, if you have a question at this time, please dial *1 to enter the queue. The next question will come from Alessandro Sassoon with Florida Today Gannett. Please go ahead.
Hey, yeah, so I'm a reporter with Florida Today, which is the Gannett newspaper for the USA Today Network in Brevard County, Florida. Brevard County is a very, very, very deep red suburban county in central eastern Florida. We're home to the Space Center. We're having the big first manned launch on May 27th, which, while NASA has said, please don't come to see the launch back during the shuttle days, manned launches would attract tens, if not hundreds of thousands of spectators. All this is happening right as the state of Florida is starting its opening plan on Monday. Restaurants and beaches are reopening. Restaurants are opening with 25% indoor seating capacity with 6 feet spacing, and outdoor seating is okay. All this also to the backdrop of in Florida, there's a huge question of how much we can believe the numbers and what do the numbers really mean. We know both through reporting I've done and now it's gained traction nationally after the Tampa Bay Times picked it up, but data that the Department of Health collects doesn't align with data that the medical examiners collect. And what's more, we know that contact tracing is really bare bones. We only have 4 contact tracers working at the Department of Health serving this county of 600,000 people, and we have several hundred confirmed cases. Testing, of course, continues to remain a problem. And private entities don't really transparently report their testing data, and they're now doing the majority of testing on antibody tests, which are completely unregulated. We know that there's huge reliability issues from other reporting. So I guess my question is, and given the also the kind of demographics politically of the county, when I go outside, there's not people wearing masks all that much. I'd say maybe 20% of people wear masks, and there's a lot of the it's a hoax thinking, I think, is very prevalent. So given the inability to actually make sense of numbers because the reliability of those numbers is questionable, and the other dynamics of the county, I'm curious to sort of hear what you think the approach should be on covering things. And I kind of came onto the call a little late due to some technical difficulties, but you were mentioning something about length of hospital stays being an indicator, and I wanted to just ask you if you could restate that that comment, because I have some information on length of hospital stays. I want to make sense of it. Sorry for that long-winded question.
No, sure. No, thank you for the question. And I'll try to answer a few pieces to it and let me know if there's anything outstanding. To your first point, to the last point first, I was just conversing with a gentleman from the Dallas Morning News who was talking about length of hospital stays and whether that would be an effective metric to gauge whether social distancing in effect was effective, was keeping apart asymptomatic individuals with COVID-19, could you use that specific metric, length of hospital stays, to monitor the effectiveness of this broader policy? And the answer was no. The two are very different. Social distancing, as was appropriately mentioned, is meant to keep all of us that are generally pretty healthy apart from each other, because we know COVID-19 is transmitted overwhelmingly by asymptomatic individuals who wouldn't otherwise come to medical attention. The length of hospital stay metric is useful because as states invariably adopt their own return to normalcy strategy, we need to know what's capacity at all the major medical centers in all these states and all the states in our country, because if we don't have enough capacity and people have long lengths of stay, that's problematic. Because if we got this wrong and we're opening up the country too soon, and a lot of us think we are, and this is too patchwork, too messy, we're going to need hospitals to be the fail-safe again. And if length of stays are really high, then that's a problem. So that's I'll stop there. To your larger question, I think the data is the data, and there's always going to be contrarian views, and it's not my I prefer to avoid sort of the terrain of politics and just focus on the data. But I will say that these conspiracy theories and hoaxes, masks, or you name it, we wouldn't have to be fighting that battle nearly as much if there was more alignment between our elected leaders and our public health experts. And so I guess I will leave it at that.
Thank you. Brandon? The next question will come from Ryan Blethen with the Seattle Times. Please go ahead.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking the time today. I'm going to ask about some questions about contact tracing. How effective is contact tracing given the high number of people who are asymptomatic with this virus? Contact tracing, you have to kind of know who's been exposed, and with this high number of people, we just don't know right now. And then how important, is contact tracing when considering reopening? Given that, we don't have broad-based testing, here in Seattle or really kind of anywhere across the country. Thanks.
Thanks for the question. And it's a really important one for us to be talking about more of, which we had more of a national debate on this. So the contact tracing is relevant to all of us, whether we have symptoms or not. And it speaks to the larger point about how this notion that we can train an army of manual contact tracers to do the job that tech could do more easily or in parallel is fanciful, in my opinion. The problem here is, to your point, the way contact tracing works in theory is you have an individual who tests positive, and you can go back, and that individual could then identify where they've been, who they've interacted with within 3 to 6 feet in the prior 2 weeks. Imagine going about your daily lives. Would you ever be able to do that? Would you be accurately able to capture everyone that you interacted with in passing or more intimately in the prior 2 weeks? I certainly know I would not be able to do that. I think there's just recall bias, there's memory issues, there's all types of just, human error. So that's going to limit the efficacy of a manual contact tracing effort. The Google, Apple, Amazon solutions, name the company, are trying to circumnavigate that through the technology that you may have heard of. So Google and Apple have done a lot of publicity about what they're trying to do. And the idea here is it gets at this question that you're talking about, I think pretty innovatively. It basically says, if you download this app and comply with having Bluetooth GPS monitoring of your location for an undetermined period of time, you have control over it, then it requires basically everybody in a community to buy in and say, yes, we're all going to agree to having our location monitored over, say, the prior 2 weeks. What then happens is if you or I were to become ultimately diagnosed with COVID-19 in the presence or absence of symptoms, this app will then say, under certain criteria, it will prompt the person that was diagnosed positive to say, were you experiencing fever, shortness, breath, or cough, or shortness of the sore throat? I know the CDC has enumerated more symptoms as of yesterday. If you were feeling any of these symptoms in the last 2 weeks, it would then ping anybody. It would give them a push notification to say, you were in contact with somebody who just got diagnosed with COVID-19 that had symptoms or didn't have symptoms. And the push notification would depend on how close you were to that individual. So if that person was symptomatic, if you were within six feet of that individual at any point in time in the last 2 weeks, you would get a push notification to get potentially tested. If that person was asymptomatic but was found to be positive, you would have to have been within 3 feet. I'm giving you an example, but this is how tech is trying to build in precision into an effort that is otherwise very complicated. Manual efforts are part of the solution, but I mean, just in me walking you through what Google and Apple are trying to do in this space, imagine a human being being able to do that. The recall issues on both on the person that was potentially exposed are enormous. So I think that's the piece here where tech, Singapore and others are trying to leverage tech. We have to scale this up quickly. To your last question, is this important? I think it's vital. Once we move from mitigation, where we're all separate from each other, to containment, and presuming we can get more testing, so that's the key piece here, presuming we can get a better handle on what's happening with true infection rates over time, hopefully we will, we'll be able to more confidently move into that phase of trace, identify, and quarantine. Tracing is going to be just absolutely essential to that strategy. It's going to be the first point of action for any public health official. If they have a positive test or an individual that's positive, who was that individual proximal to in the prior 2 weeks? Identify those individuals, test them to make sure that, you know, we don't have an outbreak that gets out of hand. So this is vital, but it's also dependent on testing, as you said. There's no way to say otherwise.
Thank you. As a quick reminder, if you have a question at this time, please dial *1 to enter the queue. The next question will come from Brian Schmidt with the Oregonian. Please go ahead.
Hi, Brad Schmidt at the Oregonian. Thanks, Doctor, for your time. I think at the beginning of the conversation, you had suggested that essentially some of the reopening decisions are largely political, absent key metrics. Here in Oregon, you know, we have a low infection rate of about 5%, but we're also lagging pretty substantially in our rate of testing. We're in the bottom half of the country. And as we look to reopen, the state has said that they're looking for maybe 15,000 tests per week, which is, you know, less than 0.5% of our overall population. And the state has also said that it's looking to add 600 contact tracers, which is about half of the rate based on population that we would need under the 100,000 model that was proposed by Johns Hopkins. And I'm just curious if you could speak specifically about, you know, whether metrics even matter at this point. If we're all going to head towards some form of reopening, saying we don't have enough tests based on capacity or saying we don't have enough contact tracers, are we just at the point where we should be trying something, or do the numbers that I've given you give you pause that Oregon is going to reopen without enough testing capacity or tracing capacity? Thank you.
Thanks for the question. It's an important question. I think we're at, from what I've seen, so I'll answer this two ways. Let me preface this by saying up front, in an ideal world, I think we would all agree we have mass testing. We would be talking about saliva in-home self-collect options, common sense things that already exist. We should be talking about how do we scale them quickly, because I think solutions already exist. I think there's tech solutions to bolster manual solutions for contact tracers. Are these being widely adopted and discussed in mass? They're not. So there's not unity. There's certainly not a federal, you know, we lack some degree of federal leadership here in terms of messaging on the right issues and bringing consensus. So given all of that, the answer to your question is I'm not sure any of it. I think metrics is – I come from the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation, so I love metrics, and I'm every decision I make is data-driven, clinical or otherwise. Do I think that's the way the country is approaching this? Absolutely not. And this is not my opinion. This is just – you go to the New York Times front page, as somebody already mentioned, there's a heat map showing people are opening up in a data data-free zone. We have no idea what's happening with case detection rates. We only have 1% of the picture. So I think the answer is already there to your question, which is we are already playing politics, or our governors are, our president is. Some governors, I think, are on the right side of this and will be viewed as being on the right side of history. Others will not be, or are taking a risk that I don't know if is exactly calculated. So I think the cat's out of the bag, and now we are going to be racing, myself and others, my colleagues, to how do we convince people to adhere to basic tenets of infection control, knowing what we know now about transmission of COVID-19? How do we convince people to wear a mask, even though the vice president went to Mayo and was the only person in a picture of 30 people to not wear a mask, surrounded by COVID-positive patients? These are the challenges that become frustrating for the rest of us that are trying to say, okay, we recognize we're headed toward – there's an unstoppable train. We're going to open up some of the biggest states, the most populous states are opening up. How do we try to get a handle on this? So I think the short answer to your question is I don't know if it matters. I don't think metrics – I think reality is showing metrics tell a nice story, and they can provide some degree of accountability, but clearly they only have so much impact when it comes to influencing policy.
Thank you.
Thank you for the question. Again, if you have a question at this time, please dial *1 to enter the queue. The next question will come from Meredith Cohn with the Baltimore Sun. Please go ahead.
Oh, hi. So I wanted you to talk a little more about those models. I mean, how much should the public be looking at them? How much should governors be looking at them? We see them in the state and, you know, across the country, and within the state, we see different models in Maryland, you know, closer to Washington, and in Baltimore, the models seem to show that we've kind of plateaued, but the Eastern Shore, where there are chicken houses, there seem to still be rising. So, like, how do you make decisions based on them, and what should the public be taking away from these models?
It's an important question, and at a high level, how should the public consume these models? And I could rabbit hole on specific details of it, but I would love to see the public look at these models and say, "Wow, we are all of these models are conditional upon a set of actions that the American public that we all have to play our role in to ensure that the American public is safe." And that we're acting in unison to really maximize the impact of all the sacrifices all of us are going through right now. And these models, the take home that sometimes probably doesn't get clearly conveyed every time they get shown on a major news organization's broadcast, is 60,000 deaths or whatever is the new number is contingent on actions being taken through, in this specific case, through the end of May, for example. Jimmy has said repeatedly, we need social distancing to continue through at least the end of May broadly to eliminate virus transmission between individuals that's being estimated. We want that number, the ability of one person to infect another individual, it's in infectious disease epidemiology, it's called a statistic called R-naught. We want that number to be less than one before we start opening up the floodgates. And so the idea here is that the models say we're not going to really get to that number, that important statistic in infectious disease modeling, until people adopt broad-scale social distancing at the country level by the end of May. And so one of the things that gets lost in these headlines is I don't know if that comes across clearly. I certainly don't. When I hear people talk about the models, if I was otherwise blind to the models or the design of it, I would know that that meant, oh, I actually have to stay at home until the end of May, and whenever I go to the grocery store, I need to wear a mask. So So there's some key gaps in communication that all of us need to own. And I think on the academic side, and then just, you know, in terms of how it gets communicated to media and how it then gets distributed to the public. So that's one piece, that anything that whenever a model gets thrown around or whenever that word even gets said, what are the assumptions that are being made? And we need a we need to make sure the public understands that this number that we're saying, X deaths by this time, means you stay put until X date. And I think we haven't done a good enough job. And I'm saying whole of society and making that and clarifying that message. And so that's one piece. I will say some of these models now have – the IHME model has looked at the state, at state-level efforts, and then specific cities that have been really hard hit, like New York City, and try to model out different policy forecasts. And so if you're a hard-hit state, you can look at the models online and say to yourself, okay, under various policy scenarios, this is when I would feel comfortable using data from one of the leading statistical organizations in the world to consider a phased opening up. And based on what at least I've seen, it doesn't seem like the governors that have decided, hey, I'm going to open up, are following the models that are out there, whether it's the University of Washington model, models out of Northeastern or Georgetown. I mean, there's a lot of different models out there. It doesn't strike me that Governor Kemp in Georgia is looking at any of these models to inform this decision. So to answer your question directly, it would be, you know, spending any time looking at these models and asking probing questions, seeking meetings, maybe seeking clarification from the people that are doing it. Perhaps the White House or state government should be convening virtual sessions. I mean, I know we do these all the time with interested parties. Rarely are there elected leaders on the other side of the call. So that infrastructure and that muscle memory perhaps needs to be built in to how people or how our elected leaders decide to open up and when they open up. But I don't feel like those conversations are happening nearly as much as they should.
Thank you. As a quick reminder, if you have a question at this point, please dial star 1 to enter the queue.
Sorry about that. I got dropped from the call. That was my I didn't mean to interrupt you in the middle of your answer there. So I have a question. You were talking about a pretty significant lifestyle change for a prolonged period of time potentially here. And, I mean, we can talk about the politics of it and the resistance to it. But for a reasonable person looking about this lifestyle change, I mean, it's going to be very hard for restaurants to survive economically with, you know, a quarter of the people there. But for a reasonable person, this lifestyle change goes on for 6 months, a year, 18 months, or do we have no idea?
Right now, there's no distance between you and I on that. We have to start messaging and thinking reasonably about this, not just saying we don't have enough testing, we don't have enough contact tracing. I think we've probably all had our fill of hearing those specific talking points. So I'm with you. How do we get back to life safely, and how do we protect livelihoods? The best answer I have for you for how long is contingent on two things. One is, once we get a handle on testing, and hopefully that's going to be the case over the next 3 months, where we'll get a better picture through a combination of PCR and antibody testing. What's the true prevalence rate? What are we really dealing with here? We have somewhat of a picture, but not really. That will give us a sense, a crude sense, in using these models of what's actually happening more broadly. So we can build in, we don't have to test 100% of the country to really know what's happening. We just need to test maybe 10% of the country to then let the models take over and say, this is actually what's happening. And we have more confidence in our models projecting out this is what's happening with infection rates. So once we get to that point, I think hopefully in the next 3 to 6 months we will get there. That's one off-ramp from social distancing being onerous for restaurants and potentially us feeling a little bit more comfortable truly normalizing life economically if things are headed in the direction that we want them to head. The other off-ramp is a vaccine or a therapeutic. We're hearing headlines now all day, every day. Now there's headlines out of Oxford that they have a vaccine that's going to go undergo clinical trials almost immediately and might be deployed as soon as the summer. If that occurs, that's a Deus Ex Machina event, and that changes things quickly. In which, if we can scale that specific vaccine, that's a whole different discussion. It's a geopolitical discussion, it's a sourcing discussion, it's a quality and safety discussion. But if, let's say you can scale it quickly, then we can liberalize things and feel like we have a fail safe, because at least that now we know that even if we get socially intimate again, we're protected. The other is a therapeutic, is the Gilead remdesivir. I just came off a shift where six of my patients were getting it infused into them. I don't know if I'm doing something that's hurting them, harming them, irreparably. Is it saving their life? Dr. Fauci cited studies that I'm sure you've seen on the headlines yesterday that suggest maybe there is a therapeutic benefit. And so that turns out to be true. That's huge, because then this big issue, we talked about length of stay in hospitals. The reason all this matters, it all comes down to, can our hospitals handle a surge of critically ill patients if we get this wrong? And if that becomes less and less important because we either have a vaccine or we have a therapeutic that's going to save people's lives more quickly, then we can take more chances. Then we can be a little bit more risky and, okay, well, let's open up and see. Right now, we're just going into the blind and saying, well, we don't really know what's happening. We have 1 to 2% of the population tested. We have no off-ramp. We have no fail-safe. And that's the reason why all of us on the public health side are raising alarm. That's why we're upset when two California doctors are contrarian on faulty data. But if we had a fail-safe, that would give us a little bit more confidence to say, okay, let's see. And so that's why I'm saying in this very – there's no data, there's minimal data, there's no fail-safe that's hard and concrete and available. That's why we need to be incremental, even though it's seemingly unreasonable to expect people to wear masks and sit 6 feet apart in a restaurant for the undetermined future. So that's the thinking behind it, and I think – if we message along those lines, maybe it makes folks in public health seem reasonable as well.
Well, thank you. This has been fabulous. Some of my takeaways are, if I were going to go out and report this, is like to see how states open up, how people are following or not following the public health guidelines as they adapt to this. But I think also we're going to have to be going back and reporting some of the things we were reporting and when this first started, which is how capable are our hospitals and our healthcare system to potentially handle another surge. And particularly because things have been moved around the country, and including personnel and ventilators and all those other things. So some of the reporting that we saw in the beginning, we're going to have to be doing again, because if we calculate wrong on this, we could be going back into this. Let's hope that doesn't happen. Am I reading that right?
You said beautifully. Couldn't have said it better myself.
Because I can write a lead. Dr. Gupta, thank you so much. And thank you so much, Irina, and to everyone who called in. Thank you for all your great questions. Be safe out there, and we look forward to reading what you have to write.
Thank you, everybody.
And this is Irina. You can follow Carla on Twitter at RobinsCarla, and you can follow Vin Gupta at VinGuptaMD. We'll put together some resources to share out with you all. But do follow us on Twitter at cfr.org. We have a lot of resources that we're sharing out on our Twitter feed, as well as going to our website, cfr.org, Think Global Health, and foreignaffairs.com. So check out all three of those websites for resources on the pandemic, as well as much more beyond COVID-19. And please send us an email at localjournalists@cfr.org if you have suggestions for focus of any areas that you want us to focus on in coming calls. So thank you all again, and stay well.
For more event audio, subscribe on iTunes or visit us at cfr.org.